The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. What a week this has been. You have Germany's conquest of Greece, which we talked about earlier in the week, quite a lot, in fact. You have America's surrender to Iran. And then now just news yesterday of this evidently a terrorist attack in Tennessee. I'm sure the panel at the Trumpet Hour will have quite a lot to talk about later today. That's every Friday, as you know, at 4 p.m. So we'll look forward to Mr. Hilliker's program later on today. My father, by the way, recorded a program just yesterday on the Iran deal. So you can look for that to make a pretty big splash on the Trumpet website next week. I just want to make a few additional comments on that deal. There's just been so many articles and commentaries and opinion pieces on what happened in Vienna, on what happened with respect to this nuclear deal. TheTrumpet.com today, by the way, has a feature there at the top, the most robust and intrusive inspections and transparency regime ever negotiated. That's a quote, I think, from the president, the article written by Brent Nachtigall. And he's asking there, is this really intrusive, these inspections? Mr. Nachtigall writes, if in fact the deal did include the most robust and intrusive inspections and transparency regime ever negotiated, surely scientists from the IAEA would have immediate access to the suspect site to determine whether or not Iran, a known violator of such agreements, has broken the rules. One of my assistants earlier in this week just went through the chronology from around about 2000, 2001 on to today, and the repeated violations, the lies, the deception, the cheating. Mr. Nachtigall says here, this is not the case. Instead, a complex process of back and forth gets initiated in which Iran would have around a month to remove and stash the fuel and potentially destroy the facility. We went through this yesterday. Prime Minister Netanyahu brought this out in his interview with NBC. How that if you have 24 days to prepare for an inspection, well, just imagine if U.S. authorities, when raiding a drug facility, had to wait 24 days to go in. This was in Commentary Magazine yesterday. This individual steps back and tries to give a bigger picture perspective on what's happened this past week. He writes, if you think the United States just struck a poor deal, a nuclear deal with Iran, you're right. But if that's your key takeaway, you're missing the point. He says, Iran's nuclear program was last on the list of the Obama administration's priorities in talking to Tehran. The administration readily caved on Iran's nukes because it viewed the matter only as a timely pretense for achieving other cherished aims. And when he goes through this, you can think back to some of the objectives, to the agenda the Obama administration had coming in back in 2009. To fundamentally transform the United States of America. And then think about what happened soon into that first term. The Cairo speech in June of 2009. The first world leaders that President Obama contacted. He says, this is the agenda. Number one, preventing an Israeli attack on Iran. Number two, transforming the United States into a more forgiving, less imposing power. Number three, establishing diplomacy as a great American good in itself. Number 4, making Iran into a great regional power. And number 5, ensuring the legacies of the President and Secretary of State as men of vision and peace. This is an opinion piece, of course. But with respect to a few of those points, it's quite obvious that it's following right along with what we were told during the campaign in 2008, early on in the presidency of Mr. Obama in 2009. This article says the administration has always viewed Israel as an intractable troublemaker and the main catalyst for the region's woes. An Israeli strike on Iran, especially if supported by the United States, would have been yet another display of destabilizing Israeli aggression that put Middle East peace further out of reach. And so the U.S. has distanced itself from Israel and has reached out to all of these other nations in the Middle East. And has it been solving problems? Just go right down the list. Nation after after nation. Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Tunisia. It's hard to look, certainly not anywhere in that region. It's hard to find anything that you could consider a success as far as the foreign policy or diplomacy even is concerned. This, again, the piece is from Commentary Magazine. It says Obama came to office promising to limit American action as well. In his standard progressive view, the United States has been too eager to throw its weight around and impose its norms on other countries without giving sufficient thought to the resentment it might sow. He ended the war in Iraq and sought to remake the United States as a humble power. Too often, the United States starts by dictating, he told a Saudi news outlet soon after being elected. He, by contrast, would do a lot of listening. The Iran negotiations became President Obama's magnum opus on the theme of listening. Americans listen to Iranians, dictate terms, shoot down offers, insult the United States, and threaten allies. He writes, America has been humbled indeed. See, as he brings out, really this is just all part of the fundamental transformation. And look at the dangerous position that it's putting the United States in. That was brought out, even with respect to this deal this past week, that was brought out by an Israeli ambassador. This piece is from Newsmax, July 16th. American concessions in Iranian nuclear deliberations save the worst for last, freeing funding and temporary obstacles which will enable Tehran to deliver atomic weapon payloads over America. This huge rogue elephant among the herd in the negotiations living room hasn't gone unnoticed in Israel. I mean, Israel's trying to sound the alarm for America. As their U.S. ambassador, Ron Dermer, told Fox News, the Obama administration has agreed to a tailwind of sanctions relief that gives Iran both a legal nuclear program and money for an intercontinental ballistic missile system. He pointed out that since Israel and Iran are on the same side of the world, those ICBMs are for you. That's what this Israeli ambassador is saying. Look, it doesn't take an ICBM to reach Israel. They're making these so that they can reach the United States, so that they can reach Europe with these weapons. It says further, Politico has reported that top Pentagon officials have recently expressed highly critical opposing views to U.S. and international negotiators, both in public and through closed-door meetings. Only days before the Vienna deal was inked, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey told a Senate committee, "We should under no circumstances relieve pressure on Iran relative to ballistic missile capabilities and arms trafficking." That was the Pentagon's position going in. And that was the last point in those negotiations, according to Politico, that the U.S. compromised on. Okay, well, we'll go ahead and let you pursue those intercontinental ballistic missiles. And that poses a direct threat to the United States. and also to Europe. I'll have a little bit more on that from another piece that I'll get to here in just a second. But I just want to draw your attention also to the uproar in Congress, the Senate, and remind you of what I said the other day about the legislation from back in, what was it, mid-April, where basically Congress decided to turn the Constitution on its head, to go from it needing, President Obama needing two-thirds of the Senate to approve this treaty. Now he just needs a third of the Senate, which is quite possible. Let me just play you a clip from, I have mentioned this quote just the other day, but I didn't actually play the soundbite. This is when the deal was announced, Tuesday morning, July 14th. And this is the president talking about the robust debate that he expected because of how controversial this deal is, and how that, while he welcomed that, he was going to also veto any action that Congress took to prevent this from going forward. This is President Obama on Tuesday.
I believe it would be irresponsible to walk away from this deal. But on such a tough issue, it is important that the American people and their representatives in Congress get a full opportunity to review the deal. After all, the details matter. And we've had some of the finest nuclear scientists in the world working through those details. And we're dealing with a country, Iran, that has been a sworn adversary of the United States for over 35 years. So I welcome a robust debate in Congress on this issue, and I welcome scrutiny of the details of this agreement. But I will remind Congress that you don't make deals like this with your friends. We negotiated arms control agreements with the Soviet Union when that nation was committed to our destruction, and those agreements ultimately made us safer. I am confident that this deal will meet the national security interests of the United States and our allies. So I will veto any legislation that prevents the successful implementation of this deal.
He welcomes the robust debate. He welcomes scrutiny of the details. But he will veto anything, anything anyone does to prevent this from being implemented. Now, let me read to you what it said at Foreign Policy. This is from yesterday or Wednesday. President Obama turns to UN to outmaneuver Congress. It seems like it would be pretty easy for him to get this through Congress, given what Congress did to itself back in April. But just in case, steps are already being taken to bypass Congress, to go straight to the UN. The subhead here, Washington's working on a new Security Council resolution making the nuclear deal legally binding on the next president. This article says, last March, 47 Republicans, led by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, wrote a letter warning Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, that a future U.S. president could legally revoke any nuclear deal that had been negotiated by President Obama's administration with the stroke of a pen. That was Congress back in March, just warning Iran that, look, just because one president is all for this doesn't mean it's going to stick. It says they clearly didn't realize that the White House has a way of making that much harder to do. That's why it's been working all along. I mean, in these negotiations with Iran, the other negotiations have been just as important, pressuring Congress to turn the Constitution on its head back in April. And now these negotiations with the UN going right around Congress. It says the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, on Monday circulated a legally binding draft to the 15-member U.N. Security Council that, if adopted, would give the body's backing to the landmark nuclear pact, trading billions of dollars in sanctions relief for greater international scrutiny of Iran's nuclear energy program. I mean, this was in place Monday, and they announced the deal late that night, and the president came on Tuesday morning early. I mean, it was all in place. It says it also instructs states to refrain from taking any actions that would undermine the agreement. The 14-page draft resolution obtained by Foreign Policy is likely to be put to a vote by early next week. It says here, finally, the decision to take the deal to the Security Council before the U.S. Congress has concluded its own deliberations on the agreement places lawmakers in the uncomfortable position of potentially breaching a binding resolution by voting down the deal. The strategy has infuriated some Republican lawmakers who see the administration making an end run around Congress. You throw up a fuss? You think that you can actually get two-thirds of the senators to stop this? Well, we'll just get it approved at the UN and get it moving. Get that sanctions relief going. Which, as it says there, really has infuriated the few, just the few in Congress who actually are willing to put up a fight. This is a clip here I'll play for you on Lou Dobbs' program where he's interviewing Representative Ed Royce about this end run around Congress.
And your reaction to the fact that this president, this White House, is taking this deal to the United Nations for its approval, irrespective of what the United States Congress does or does not do.
Mike McCaul and I, he's chairman of Homeland Security, fired off a letter to the President of the United States directing the White House not to do that. Indeed, yesterday I called the deputy at the White House in charge of this, and today I talked to our ambassador to the United Nations to tell them, do not do this, because Congress has the right to review this document over the next 65 days. They're arguing, well, it won't go into effect for 90 days. No. What we're saying is, put this in abeyance, because we feel when the facts come out in front of the American public, we have an opportunity with some of the comments that the Pentagon has made about this to rally the American public in a bipartisan way against the agreement.
And if President Obama ignores your letter?
Well, if he ignores our letter, we're going to push forward with our resolution of disapproval, and that will include not allowing the liftings of the sanctions on the arms embargo. And so we're incorporating that into into our effort to oppose what the White House is attempting to do.
So you can see here, I mean, there's a lot that we're going to have to follow in the weeks ahead. Perhaps there are a few willing to put up a fight, but Congress doesn't have that much power. It relinquished what power it did have just a couple of months ago. Let me just conclude this segment by referring back to this Foreign Policy piece about those negotiations and what was how the U.S. capitulated there right at the 11th hour. It says, according to an individual familiar with the talks, the compromise on the arms embargo and ballistic missile sanctions came at the 11th hour of negotiations in Vienna. Iran, backed by Russia, insisted that a final deal lift all restrictions on conventional arms and ballistic missiles immediately. Why do they need all of these weapons? Why do they need these ballistic missiles? Well, they're the number one state sponsor of terrorism. It says, seeking to break the impasse, Kerry did some maneuvering between the Iranians and the Russians to get it to a 5-8 compromise. That's Secretary of State Kerry. Meaning the conventional arms embargo would be in effect for another 5 years, and restrictions on ballistic missile technology would extend for 8 years rather than lift immediately. This was a Kerry special, said the individual. This was a compromise that they were proud of. We reached a compromise. We put it off 5 to 8 years. What a victory. It says prior to the conclusion of the nuclear talks, Republicans such as New Hampshire Senator Kelly Iotti grilled Obama administration officials about the dangers of lifting sanctions on Iran that deter it from obtaining conventional weapons or ballistic missiles. It says finally, responding to this, General Martin Dempsey, the outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that under no circumstances should we relieve pressure on Iran relative to ballistic missile capabilities and arms trafficking. That was the Pentagon's counsel. Under no circumstances should this be compromised. Under no circumstances should we capitulate on this demand. But then along comes the Secretary of State, the Kerry special, the 11th hour negotiations to put it off 5 to 8 years. Just 5 years, 8 years. And of course, that's even assuming that Iran doesn't cheat. Quite a lot of ways you can cover this story. There's just so much that it impacts, and I'm sure it will carry over into next week. As I said, my father did tape a program, a Key of David program, on the subject of this deal struck with Iran. And so we'll be, I'm sure, talking about it quite a bit more heading into next week. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial right here in central Oklahoma, Edmond, just north of Oklahoma City. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. Email us your feedback, if you like, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily.
I'd like to say just a word about the framework with North Korea. This is a good deal for the United States.
A comprehensive long-term deal with Iran will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
North Korea will freeze and then dismantle its nuclear program.
Change that makes our country and the world safer and more secure.
The entire world will be safer as we slow the spread of nuclear weapons.
Every pathway to a nuclear weapon is cut off,
making it much harder for them to produce nuclear weapons. The United States and international inspectors will carefully monitor North Korea to make sure it keeps its commitments.
The international community will be able to verify the Islamic Republic of Iran will not develop a nuclear weapon.
That's from a video posted the other day. I failed to write down the name of it now that I think of it. But you can see there it's obviously comparing what President Clinton said in 1994 after the United States made a deal with North Korea. And we heard very similar language this past week. Of course, the deal with North Korea turned out to be a disaster. And so where is this new deal leading? You can see, even from fairly recent history, all the talk this week, you know, about it being a historic agreement, we're not making history here with this deal. We're repeating history. We're repeating the same mistakes. We're making the same mistakes that were made just a couple of decades ago. We're making the same mistakes that have been made throughout man's history. I heard the former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, he referred to this comment made by President Roosevelt back during the Second World War, 1943. And here was President Roosevelt getting ready for a meeting with Joseph Stalin. And in preparation for it, his advisors were warning him that Stalin would violate deals, that he wasn't an honest negotiator, that he would try to take over Eastern Europe after the war. And this is what President Roosevelt said. He said, "I just have a hunch that Stalin is not that kind of man. I think that if I give him everything I possibly can and ask for nothing from him in return, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of democracy and peace." That's what the President of the United States believed in his heart of hearts back in 1943. He could talk some sense into Stalin. He thought Stalin was a good man, an honest man, a just man. If I just give him everything that I can and ask for nothing in return, well, he won't annex anything. Would you say that was a tragic mistake? And look at the stakes today. I mean, they're so much higher because of the weapons at man's disposal. I want to read to you what Victor Davis Hanson had to say just about the unbelievable trust that man has in human nature. The title of the piece is "Progressive Elites Ignore Human Nature at Everyone Else's Expense." That's really what's at the root of all of this, is a fundamental ignorance of human nature. There's a lot of elites, a lot of educators, a lot of leaders that believe that at its core, it's good. It's holy. It's righteous. It's just. You see that belief in that quote from Roosevelt. "I just have a hunch that he's not that kind of man. I think if I just give him what he wants, he'll love me in return." In Hanson's piece here, he says, "Human nature is unchanging, predictable, and can be dangerous if ignored." Well, it does change to some extent. It gets worse, though. But he's just bringing out that there is an evil that has to be confronted or restrained, or it's just going to explode in our faces. And he gives a few examples here in his piece: 5-time deportee and 7-time felon, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, an unauthorized immigrant, recently was arrested in San Francisco for the murder of an innocent passerby, Kate Steinle. The alleged killer told a local TV station that he came to San Francisco because it was a sanctuary city. San Francisco has long boasted that it would not turn over unauthorized immigrants to federal immigration authorities. Can it be that announcing such exemptions actually draws in foreign citizens who have arrived in the U.S. illegally and committed crimes? Can it be that that actually attracts evil, those kinds of policies? He says, what is true compassion? Deporting a repeat felon like Lopez Sanchez back to his home country, or turning him loose on potential victims such as Kate Steinle? What is true compassion in that case? San Francisco is quite proud of its sanctuary city status. It's quite brazen in its defiance against federal laws, at least with respect to immigration. Hansen says here, Baltimore just fired its police commissioner, Anthony Batts, for his supposed inability to stop an epidemic of violent crime. But not long ago, after the riots that followed suspect Freddie Gray's death while in police custody, Batts and Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake had promised to rein in the police. They seem to blame Baltimore's police culture for Gray's death, even before the indictments and trials of the arresting officers involved. Amid the rioting, Rawlings Blake infamously assured Baltimore that we also gave those who wished to destroy space to do that as well. We gave space to the rioters, that's true. Hansen says the murder rate in Baltimore has nearly doubled since the May riots. Non-fatal shootings in Baltimore have also surged. Is it possible that when offenders become convinced, they would not necessarily be arrested or even questioned, and would be given space to burn while police were blamed for being too proactive, these offenders became more visible and police less visible? You see what he's talking about here? He's talking about cause and effect. Is it possible that when you handcuff the police, that criminals are going to start showing up in droves? What happens when you remove restraint? What happens in a culture of lawlessness? It says, given human nature, people also like to blame their self-created dilemmas on cosmic forces not of their own making. Take Greece. The Greek government cooked its books to finagle streams of borrowed Northern European cash. We've talked a lot this week about Germany, of course, imposing its will on Greece. But Greece has a lot of problems. There's no doubt about that. They cook their books, and then they want to blame it on others. That's human nature. That is human nature. It's a particularly ugly aspect of that carnal nature. Not taking blame for your own mistakes. Not learning the lessons from history. It says the Greeks spent what they could not earn faster even than it could be lent. Now Greece is broke and cannot pay back what it owes. But do not suggest to the Greeks that their own endemic tax avoidance, feather bedding, and corruption caused their financial collapse. It's so much easier for humans to blame them. It's so much easier. It's their fault. It's their problem that caused all of this. In this case, German creditors who either loaned Greeks too much money or made too much money on the loans, or who had Nazi grandparents who once occupied Greece 75 years ago. There's always enough blame to go around to everyone else. Finally, this is the end of Victor Davis Hanson's piece at National Review, I think it was. He says, this is his conclusion, in all these cases, progressivism assured us that human nature, self-centered and predictable, could be improved. Enlightened new theories and policies promised to change behavior by no longer ensuring hurtful punishments or consequences for bad behavior and unwise choices. take away the punishment, and behavior will improve. I mean, that in essence is what the president of the United States said just yesterday, talking to prisoners in a prison, implying that they were put in there for no good reason because of a justice system that's flawed, that doesn't work. I mean, we're heading into some pretty dangerous times for American cities. It says in his piece, in truth, if humans do not face bridles on their often dangerous appetites and recklessness, they are emboldened to do a great deal of damage, not just to themselves, but also to others. Those who borrow sums that they cannot pay back usually blame those who lent them the money, not their own appetites. Oh no, not those. It says, and elites never seem to pay firsthand for the consequences of their own naive and selfish theories about human nature. Well, he says they never seem to pay firsthand, but those sins are coming back on all of us. Those sins of all of our people, the selfishness, that evil human nature, it's just running out of control now because you're removing those last forms of restraint. And we're heading to anarchy. Man doesn't understand the plague of his own heart, as it says in 1 Kings 8. That's what God's assessment of the human heart is. It's like a disease, Jesus said, a sickness. And it can be improved and healed. Mr. Hansen doesn't understand the spiritual truth of the matter. The only healing, though, comes from God. Every once in a while, you get a tiny glimpse of an attitude that, as I said last week, with respect to the response of quite a few people in Charleston, that spirit of unselfish giving, of unselfish sacrifice for others. But the overwhelming majority in our society and around the world, everyone's in it for their own self-interest. It was important for Iran to get what it wanted out of that deal. It was important that they get the right to purchase and to stockpile ballistic missiles. They need them to further their interests. And so along comes the Secretary of the State, who basically says, well, I've looked at Iran's foreign minister. I've negotiated with this people, and I just don't think they're that kind of individual that would blow people up. And here they've been doing it for 30 years. They've done it with our own American soldiers in Iraq. 500 of them have died, have been killed because of Iranian weapons. Look at the ignorance there is with respect to human nature. Nothing man does or proposes will cure this disease, this sickness, this plague. Let's just look at what Jesus said. I mentioned it. This is over in Matthew chapter 9. The solution to this widespread sickness is God and His Spirit, God's law and government, God's truth. In Matthew 9, verse 10, it says, and it came to pass, as Jesus sat at meat in His house, or in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with Him and His disciples. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto His disciples, why eats your Master with publicans and sinners? But when Jesus heard that, He said to them, they that behold need not a physician, but they that are sick. But go you and learn what that means. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Jesus came to heal the sick. And look at this world. Look at the sickness. Look at the disease that's spreading. I'm talking spiritual. Of course, there's an application here too with respect to the physical. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 says, the heart, that's the human heart. This is human nature. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can know the human heart, the plague of the human heart? God has to reveal this to us. That's what the following verse says, Jeremiah 17, then verse 10. I, the Lord, search the heart. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. God has to reveal it to us. God has to show us. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, in his book, Mystery of the Ages, I mean, he talked about early on in that publication about just the advances in technology that we've all seen in our modern world. He talked about how he lived through the buggy age, the horse and buggy age, the automobile age, the industrial age, air travel, nuclear age, space age. He lived all across the 20th century, most of it, dying there in early 1986. He says, all through, this is in Mystery of the Ages, all through this long and pulsating, eventful life, I have asked myself many questions that were deep mysteries to me and remain unanswered and unexplained mysteries to the world as a whole. I mean, one of these mysteries has to do with the evil in man. And this great paradox, as he often talked about, all of this explosion of knowledge, education, modern education, right alongside accelerating evils, evil advancing just as fast. Mr. Armstrong really did see the big picture. He had vision, as it says in the Proverbs. He really was a man of vision. He really did look forward. He really did look ahead. And he really did look to God for the understanding, for the knowledge, for the truth, for the power to really raise up an institution, a church, a college, all these wonderful youth programs that we've talked about before. Here we are, right in the middle of our Philadelphia youth camp on this campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. All these wonderful young people coming from all over the world with beautiful attitudes, being trained up in the way that they should go. I mean, it does take training. This is brought out in the scriptures, in the Proverbs. Involved parents, the administration of God's laws, and even punishment at times, to teach godly lessons, to reinforce God's truth. You remove all the restraint, and what you're left with are children or young people that run wild. There's a lot of fully grown children today, adults I mean, that are just out there running wild. They don't understand the truth about human nature. Let's look over at 2 Timothy chapter 1, and we'll start to wind this down. 2 Timothy 1. Mr. Armstrong and talking about that educational system that he established back in the late 1940s. He established them on the principles of God's laws, God's truth. This is how he defined one of the educational objectives for students at Ambassador College. He said the objective is to develop right mental habits, intellectual curiosity, self-discipline, independent and clear thinking and love of truth and scholarship. That's what young people at Armstrong College are here to learn. Right mental habits, self-discipline, independent and clear thinking, and a love for truth. Jesus said, God's word is truth. He also said, God's truth sets you free. This is the only path to freedom. It has to be based on God's truth. It has to be of God if we're to remove the plague of the human heart. And so here in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 6, Paul says, wherefore I put you in remembrance that you stir up the gift of God which is in you by the putting on of my hands. Stir it up, Paul said to Timothy. Stir up this gift of God. He received the Holy Spirit after baptism and the laying on of hands, after repentance and faith and baptism. He received the Holy Spirit of God. And Paul said to him, you stir this up, this power from God, this mind of God. Verse 7 says, for God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. True love comes from God. Soundness of mind, a balanced mind, that comes from God. God will give it to His children who subject themselves to His laws, to His government, to His truth. That's what God's church today, that's what God's college today is here to build and to raise up this way of life, education with vision. That's our motto here at the college. Education with vision. Let's just conclude over in the Psalms and finish on a very positive note here. In a world that's getting more and more dark by the day, darkness is setting in. Danger is all around. And yet God has a plan. God has a solution. It's starting in the smallest of ways, but it's also growing. This is Psalms, right at the beginning, Psalm 1 and verse 1. It says, blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law does he meditate day and night. That's what Paul was getting at when he told Timothy to stir it up. Make sure you're diligent in your prayers to God, in your study of God's truth, in your study of God's word. Verse 3 says, and he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth his fruit in his season, his leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he does shall prosper. See, as long as we strive to please and to obey God, we will prosper spiritually, first and foremost. Cause and effect. We need laws. We need government. We need to establish our lives, our families, on truth. We need to teach our children right from wrong. That's where their sure foundation will come from. Then they'll be, as it says here, like that tree planted by the rivers of water and bring forth all kinds of fruit. Well, it's been a fast-moving week, for sure. And I'm sure there's quite a lot more that we'll be hearing about the week that was later on today with the Trumpet Hour. That plays at 4 p.m. right here on KPCG in Edmond, Oklahoma, 101.3 on the FM dial. Also, I just want to remind you that the Trumpet Weekly comes out at the end of the day on Friday. That's our email publication that collects all of the most important stories from the week that was. We collect them for you there on a document, an email document, and we send it out electronically. All those top stories, 10 or 12 pages of material that will help you understand the real significance of these events that we see happening in this world. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show. As I said, 101.3 on the FM dial. And the live stream is at kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening today.